appears to be a small bird's nest, but there are neither birds nor eggs nestled inside. What is depicted, says the ad, is a, quote, golden nest egg, a gold coin from South Africa worth approximately $411, depending on the gold market. It's a relatively unimpressive coin, showing a deer-like animal on one side and the legend 1 ounce fine gold. 12 of the coins equals 1 pound of gold, as there are 12 troy ounces in 1 pound. Buying gold is not like buying apples and oranges, or even meat, expensive as that is these days. In Fairbanks, Krugerrands are sold in units of 20 by Alan Johnston of Wedbush Noble Cook, a brokerage house. He also sells Mexican 50 peso coins, again in units of 20. They're valued at around $505 each, depending, of course, on the market. Unlike the plainer Krugerrands, they are quite magnificent. They're approximately the size of the old U.S. silver dollars and show an eagle with a serpent in its beak on the one side, the tail, and a winged, bare-breasted woman on the other. Even the mountains behind her look grand. The pesos are inscribed on the side as well. Independencia y libertad, they say. Maybe it refers to the independence and liberty of those people rich enough to buy them. A white translucent container of 20 of the coins weighs 24 troy ounces, or 2 pounds, and would easily fit into a pocket, a blue jean pocket even. Why, I asked Johnston, while I fingered that wonderful gold 50 peso piece, would someone buy gold coins?
The most common reason people are buying gold coins is they feel that they're insurance, just in case the economy collapses. They want to have something tangible, something mobile that they can take with them.
But why coins as opposed to other forms of gold?
If somebody comes into you and gives you an ounce of dust or small nuggets, and they tell you that it's 72% pure or 82% pure, you're taking their word for it. You know, they're probably telling you the truth. But when you go and sell it to somebody else, then they're getting it second or third hand. They may believe in you, but they're not sure. With the Krugerrands, there's a ready market for it. You can buy the coins and sell the coins the same day, and there's no problem as far as getting the money. The question is the price.
What kinds of people buy gold? Uncle Scrooges, who want to surround themselves with their wealth? Tiddlywink aficionados, tired of plastic tiddlies and winks and hoping for a bigger thrill? People wanting lumpy mattresses filled with gold coin, or just rich folks hoping for bigger riches?
The people buying the pounds or the tons of gold are the large moneyed interest, and when they buy gold, they're buying it for a longer term and not so much for the short-term fluctuations. People buying the ingots or the Krugerrands or things like that are the smaller moneyed people looking for their insurance hedge. But a lot of people are starting to do it for speculation and profit also. These people, you know, it's the average consumer or the you and me, is that we're much more emotional as far as the minor fluctuations in the market. And many people now aren't buying it for the insurance, they're buying it as a speculation. And should it drop a little bit, they get very nervous and they sell immediately.
Johnston went on to caution against the notion that buying gold is the path through wealth. Instead, he suggested other, perhaps less glamorous, but quicker ways to riches.
Gold is a passive investment. You're going to make more money with an active investment. If the person would take that amount of money and put it into an older house and fix it up, they'd do much better. Over the long term, it really doesn't appreciate in value. It's just considered a store of value. Where there's other investments that actually do appreciate, or you can add value to yourself.
In spite of that admonition, Johnston admits that Fairbanks has a very active gold market. How many people invest in gold locally, says Johnston?
I say there's very few people that aren't, in some way or other.
That includes those gold nugget watch bands, rings with golden ram heads bearing three-quarter curls, and who knows, maybe people with lots of gold fillings. So if you thought buying meat was costly, just wait until the next time you visit the dentist. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The Fairbanks Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance Center, or WICA, is a state and federally funded organization that started in September 1975 primarily as a rape crisis program. Since then, the organization has expanded its services to include a program for abused wives and a rural education program. Barrow already has a center, and facilities are being planned for Minto and Tok. Most of the cases that Wicca handles in Fairbanks relate to incidences of domestic violence. Carla Slaughter, executive director of Wicca, explains what falls under that category.
Spousal abuse or between partners. You don't necessarily have to be married to the person who abused you.
Both heterosexual and homosexual, I assume.
Although we haven't had any instances of homosexual violence, or it's, you know, they haven't been reported to us. Yeah.
Do you feel that you get a very large percentage of people who actually report incidences to you?
Yeah, we get lots of people who report incidences to us as far as reporting to the police in order to have that, you know, at least noted down somewhere. That happens less.
Okay, so what happens? Say my husband beat me up. I call you. What next?
We ask you to come down and talk to a counselor if you can. If not, we're more than happy to talk to someone over the phone and then ask if you'd like to stay with us for a while in order to be able to leave the violent situation. Often a woman can't do that because it just creates a little more anger, hostility, and tension in the home. But eventually, we usually do see everyone we talk to on the phone.
If the person can't get to you, will you go to them?
Mm-hmm, we will.
Sometimes take them to a neutral location?
Yeah.
I assume,
or whatever. If the husband's being very violent, or the partner, whoever the person is, we prefer not to do that, to ask her if she can possibly leave, leave the house, and then we will meet her somewhere and pick her up, just because we're not the police and we're not trained to deal with extremely violent situations like that. But if she would like to report it, the police will take us out there.
But it's not required that a person who comes to you subsequently goes to
the
police?
Oh, no, not at all, not at all.
Is rape a category of domestic violence?
I don't think it's really included in domestic violence, only because without the new criminal code, it's not yet illegal for a husband to rape, for a husband to rape his wife. So I don't think it's really included in the area of domestic violence, but it is definitely violence, and it's most usually against women.
What is the relative percentage of incidences of rape relative to other types of domestic violence?
We receive, I think the ratio is 3-1 calls for domestic violence as opposed to rape. We get many more calls for domestic violence than we do for rape.
But in the past, Fairbanks had the highest percentage of rape of anywhere in the nation.
It did. It had the largest per population rape rate in the nation. I think we've dropped down to number 3 or 4 now, but we held the number 1 slot for a couple of years.
Why do you think we've dropped?
Hopefully, I would like to believe it's because of programs like ours. There are 10 of us around the state organized programs, and I would like to believe that that had something to do with the drop in the rate.
While called a women's crisis center, the facility has also received calls from children reporting domestic violence in their family and currently has 11 male clients, primarily husbands who don't like what has happened in their marital relationships and would like to do something about it. Wicca hopes to expand its services and ability to serve and house more people. Carla Slaughter has been with the organization through previous growth periods in her more than 2 years there. How does she feel personally about her work?
It's real close to my heart, actually. However, it's trying kind of work. I guess anybody who works in human services organization feels the same way about that. You get real attached, but it's real easy to get burned out.
You feel that's happening to you now?
Oh, I don't know. It might be. I've got a little energy left. I don't know how much, though.
Carla Slaughter, Executive Director of the Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance Center in Fairbanks. I'm Karen McPherson. The commercial fishing season in the interior was exceptionally good this year, according to Fred Anderson, Upper Yukon Area Management Biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Exceptionally strong king run, possibly one of the better runs in the last 25 to 30 years.
But the chums, or dog salmon, did not follow that trend.
The summer run of chums was the exception this year. It was somewhat mediocre. The catches were average or somewhat less than average for the last five-year period.
Luckily for people fishing, though, the fall run of silvers was strong. Possibly a record number of fish were caught by what Anderson estimates is between 190 and 200 commercial gillnetters and fish wheel operators. That's from Anvik on upstream as far as the Canadian border, including the Tanana drainage. That figure includes around 45 people in the Tanana drainage, 100 or so between Anvik and Ruby, and the balance primarily in the villages of Rampart and Tanana. people fishing commercially must obtain limited entry permits, either through what Anderson termed grandfather rights or by purchasing a permit from someone who has one, and that can run up to $15,000. While due to the permit requirement, there has not been an increase in numbers of people fishing commercially, there has been an increase in subsistence activity. In the Fairbanks area alone, 230 subsistence permits were issued this year in contrast to 170 last year. Anderson admitted that a number of non-commercially caught fish found their way into the commercial market. And what if someone wanted to get into that market? Other than purchasing a permit from someone else, did they stand much chance of obtaining a limited entry fishing permit?
Not really. The Entry Commission is conducting a study on the Upper Yukon to determine whether or not the limited entry system, as it is now, is meeting the needs of the people in the fishery on the river. Uh-huh. It may be that this study will result in more permits being issued, but that decision is one that will have to be made by the legislature.
Fred Anderson of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Less than 22% of all registered voters moved their bodies to the polls yesterday in Fairbanks, a low turnout given the intensity of radio, television, and newspaper advertising in the days preceding the election. There were the usual ads proclaiming the candidate to be a friend of the people, a friend of petrochemical development, a friend of big business in general, an enemy of any of those, and where applicable, a lifelong Alaskan. That's always a popular cause, at least for non-native candidates. Length of residency is, the theory goes, associated with ability to, quote, represent the people. That theory appeared to work last night for Borough Mayor John Carlson, re-elected to a 3-year term, his last, over Gil D'Innocent, a relative newcomer with either 2 or 4 years in the community, depending on which ads you read or listened to. D'Innocent was an avowed libertarian candidate in an ostensibly nonpartisan election. The third candidate, John Eubank, while a longtime resident, received less than 1,000 of the better than 7,000 votes cast. He had been seriously hurt early in the campaign by the revelation that he had served time for manslaughter a number of years past. Though in one televised presentation, Eubank appealed to the voters to forget the incident, if they did, he would, it was clear that voters were not going to forget, though he had recently received a presidential pardon. Borough assembly races were much tighter than the mayoral contest. 3 seats were on the ballot, and there was a clear victor in only one. For seat G, Bruce Womack, a Libertarian, had more than 1,000 votes better than his nearest competitor. Losers for that seat were Glenn Judé and Charles Stevenson. Seat F is still too close to call, with Dave Brennan, the incumbent, leading Jack Randolph, also affiliated with the Libertarians, by only 50-some votes. By Friday, all outstanding ballots should be counted and that race decided. But for seat A, it's a different story. 40% of the votes are required for a clear win, and none of the candidates had quite enough. There will be a runoff in 3 weeks between incumbent Kevin Herron and Andy Carella, who had been on the borough assembly in a different seat, but chose to run against Herron in the only nasty campaigning in the election. The third candidate in that race was Mike McGowan. Back to that nasty business. In a full-page ad in last Friday's Daily Newsminer, Carella resorted to red-baiting tactics, stating that one of the assemblymen made him, quote, see red. Among the accusations were that this assemblyman, unnamed in the ad, though clearly Herron, was openly working for the Fairbanks Environmental Center prior to election. Ironically, only 2 years earlier, Carella himself campaigned as a people's candidate, some of the issues in which he chose to attack incumbent Herron. In other races, incumbent school board member Marguerite Stetson easily defeated recreational drug use advocate John Waterman, and H.O. Williams retained his seat, running unopposed. In city council races, Ruth Burnett was unopposed for seat A. For seat B, Mike Michael defeated Tony Schultz and Tom Waters. And for seat F, Ron Punton easily outdistanced John Riggs and Mary Johnson. All 3 city bond propositions, 2 for sewer and water systems, and the other for $12,500,000 in revenue bonds to improve municipal utility system facilities, passed, though the last one barely squeaked by. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. At stake are 3 city bonds, 3 city council seats, 2 school board seats, 3 borough assembly seats, and the borough mayor. Since Fairbanks does not have a unified city-borough government, only residents of the appropriate area may vote for candidates and issues concerning them. For example, a borough resident may not vote on the city bonds or the city council seats, but both city and borough residents may vote for school board. Although turnout is usually light in local elections, a sample of passers-by at the university could indicate different, if not particularly enlightened, voting patterns this time around. You going to vote today?
Nope.
You going to vote today?
Yes.
You think your vote's going to make a difference?
Yes, I do.
How's that?
Because I think each voter counts, and I don't think people should be apathetic about it.
You going to vote today?
Yes, I am.
Why?
Because I feel that it's more or less the duty of every registered voter, or of every person, to vote and to make their voice heard.
Do you think your vote makes a difference?
I certainly hope so.
You going to vote today?
I already did vote.
Did you know before you got there who you were going to vote for?
Yes, there were a couple races I was specifically interested in, and I voted for those.
Why is that?
Because they were the only races I really cared about, where it seemed like the candidates were different enough to vote for.
Borough mayor isn't important?
It's important, but it seemed like six of one, half a dozen of the other.
You gonna vote?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't know what's going on.
You gonna vote today?
No, I'm not registered. I'm new in town.
You gonna vote today?
Oh, yes, of course.
You think your vote makes a difference?
Yeah, I don't know whether it makes a difference or not. Maybe in Fairbanks, because we're small enough. Maybe one vote does.
You gonna vote today?
I've already voted.
Did you vote for everything?
Yes, I did.
You think it's gonna make a difference?
Everyone's vote makes a difference.
You gonna vote today?
No.
You gonna vote today?
Yes, I am.
You think your vote's gonna make a difference?
I hope so.
You gonna vote for everything on the ballot?
Yes.
But you can't. You can only vote for borough things or city things.
Oh, okay, whatever.
You gonna vote today?
Yes, I am.
You think your vote makes a difference?
I hope so.
Has experience in the past shown you it does?
Some of the candidates I vote for get elected, some don't. It's never been by a one-vote margin. I have certain rights as an American citizen, as a citizen of Alaska, but those rights are only valid as I take the responsibilities that come with them.
You gonna vote today?
I already did.
Did you vote for all the available openings?
Me, did I vote for one for all the categories?
Uh-huh.
Well, of course I did.
You think your vote's gonna make a difference?
No.
Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Conflicts between individuals and agencies of the government are not uncommon. And right now, there's considerable disagreement between a mountain climber named Doug Buchanan, president of the Alaskan Alpine Club, and the National Park Service. Actually, there's a third party in this dispute, the Alaska Alpine Club. There are two groups with almost identical names, both claiming to represent climbers. The Alaska Club has been in existence since 1954, but the Alaskan Club was formed just a few months ago. The National Park Service enters the picture because the Alaskan Alpine Club, or rather Buchanan, has been receiving a lot of publicity recently for signs club members intend to plant on mountain summits. Brown metal signs on aluminum poles with reflective white letters saying, "Park Service, go home." Buchanan claims that the Park Service places excessive requirements on climbers that interfere with their basic freedoms to climb when, where, how, and with whom they wish. The Alaska Alpine Club, on the contrary, disavows any involvement with the sign-in and is supportive of the National Park Service. And the National Park Service says that they have good relations with the nationally respected Alaska group, but are peeved with Buchanan's misrepresentation of Park Service regulations for climbers. Bob Bellis, information officer for the National Park Service in Anchorage, clarifies current Park Service regulations for climbers.
There are only two peaks in any park in Alaska that require certain kinds of backcountry use permits or registrations or radios or other requirements, and those are McKinley and Four Acre, both in Mount McKinley National Park. Mm-hmm. There we have a requirement on those two peaks only for a registration of the climbing party, both in and out, a signed medical statement that each member of the party is in fit medical condition for that kind of climb on just Four Acre and McKinley, and radios for communication. Now, I'd like to point out that this office has already gone on record as wanting to waive the last two requirements for those two peaks, the requirement of a medical statement and the requirement of a radio to be carried by the climbing party.
I told Buchanan of Bellis' remarks, which appeared to contradict his claims of increased Park Service regulation.
Very typical of the National Park Service. They tell a lot of different people a lot of different things. Area Director, National Park Service, Alaska Area Director John Cook announced at the news conference announcing the final proposed regulations that he intended to bring climbing regulations in Alaska in line with Kluane Park regulations in Canada because we had a park with a mutual border. These regulations are quite restrictive.
Said Bellis.
The regulations that Canadians have for that park are more stringent than the ones that we operate with in McKinley or elsewhere in the state. Mm-hmm. There is no move at this time to adopt in any way their regulations. However, at a recent press conference, Park Service Director for Alaska John Cook did mention that we are trying to explore ways of coordinating between the difference in their management system and ours in the Kluane, Wrangell St. Elias area. This would mainly apply to people who might enter the park on the U.S. side for a climb on the Canadian side. That is, they would enter the Canadian park under the less stringent regulations that we would have.
Buchanan's protestations against Park Service regulations, both in effect and proposed, have taken the form of press conferences and news releases. But soon, if not already, those reflective metal signs will be planted. Why signs? Said Buchanan.
It's a publicity effort.
Countered Bellis.
Placing that kind of item on top of a mountain is so out of place and is such an insult to other climbers that I think that if Mr. Buchanan or whoever else he might be operating with to do such a thing, they might consider some sort of response from the Alaska Alpine Club.
Buchanan didn't speak and won't, he says, with the Alaska Alpine Club, but I did. Here's Club Officer Dan Osborne.
The Alaska Alpine Club has not participated in any of those activities. The press has reported numerous times that the Alaska Alpine Club is doing this or that, and that is wrong.
Well, wrong or right, Buchanan has gotten the media coverage he seeks. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Oh, the chimney's falling down and the roof is tumbling. Creaks out in the sunlight and the rain. And the only friend I've got now is this good old dog of mine and the little log cabin in the lane.
Like many Alaskans, I've got a little log cabin, a new one ready for its first winter. Though it's got big logs and lots of insulation in the floor and ceiling, the door is drafty, the barn sash windows are mostly single pane, and when rosy-fingered Don reaches the dormers upstairs, its fingers also pry into the cracks around the windows. Clearly, this squirrel has work to do before the newly bare trees become brittle with frost, and that's not too far away. The Alaska Federation for Community Self-Reliance in Fairbanks has a service for people like me, people aware there's energy being lost and ways to fix those heat loss problems. It's called the Home Energy Audit Service. Jim Olney and Ellen Brown came to my cabin recently to conduct a home energy audit. Before we started, Jim explained what he and Ellen would be doing.
Basically, we check a house from roof to foundation, identify where the heat loss is, and make suggestions where needed to cut the heat loss, that is, to save fuel.
For this service, the auditors charge between $25 and $50, depending on the size of the dwelling. But they admit that of the dozen homes, well, 13, including mine, some had paid and some had not. After the second cup of morning coffee, their 13th energy audit began.
We'll start by doing around the house measurements and inspection to see just how tightly the house is constructed and what materials are used.
After inquiring about quantities of insulation, types of windows, log joining, and such, after eyeing my leaky, uninsulated door, Ellen explained the biggest culprit in heat loss, infiltration.
Infiltration is where most people lose most of their heat, the inside air that's coming into the house that has to be warmed up to room temperature. As you can see around the windows here, there's quite a bit of crack that can be stuffed and caulked.
Oh, yeah.
Because any of that air that's getting in through there is going to make your house a lot colder and the heat's going to get out, too.
Jim went on to inspect the vapor barrier in the roof and its ventilation.
There's adequate ventilation here for the roof. I see one point. The extreme is having your roof rafters rot out. And we did inspect a house where the homeowner said, I don't understand why we have a little dip over here on the roof. Can you take a look at it? And oh, my Lord. It was obvious after we had had the impression to start with, and it was confirmed when we were up on the roof that, in fact, there was considerable structural damage to the roof members.
And now that we were outside, Jim got back to those leaky windows.
You can see around your windows here, there's a lot of ceiling to do. Infiltration mm-hmm. in your house is probably, will be, since this is your first, your coming upcoming winter, would be one of your major concerns to block up. Of course, when we were standing inside the house and could see light underneath the door, that is a prime sign that some weather stripping is in order.
A lot of these things that people can do to their houses don't involve real expensive items, you know, maybe 10 tubes of caulk. And if you wanted to get the most expensive caulk, that would be $5 a tube, but you can get cheaper caulk than that. And another thing that we're suggesting that saves people a lot of money is shuttering their windows with foam, say, from the outside.
They explained that double layers of, say, plastic such as Visqueen and Mylar and curtains created air traps inside that would cause condensation and frost buildup. And all these winters, I thought that frosty windows were just part of the charm of the season. You know, that extra sparkle to the northern lights? Lots of people up here build their own homes, though others contract for the work or purchase existing structures. Ellen described two houses built by contractors that they had seen recently, one energy efficient and the other what they called an energy hog.
We saw two houses out in North Pole. Yeah. One was, I'd say, about 5 years older than the other. Both contractor-built houses, one that was of excellent construction. The other one was 2x4 construction, all electric heat, no vapor barrier, no vapor barrier on the ground beneath his crawl space. The floor insulation was absolutely soaked. This guy paid the same amount of money for this house that the other man had paid for the well-insulated, well-built house. So it's a matter of consumer awareness more than anything else. People just have to know what to look for. I think a major part of our program is just to make people more aware of what it is that they are buying or they are living in. Before somebody goes and plunks down $65,000, I think they should be aware of just exactly what it is that they are buying. We have seen some houses where people have bought the homes and not even realized, you know, what was in their houses. And if people contact us, we can tell them easy ways to take off light fixtures or take out a receptacle on the wall, and they can see what's inside their wall and see exactly what it is they are getting.
Well, I know what I'm getting. A few tubes of silicone caulking, fiberglass to stuff around the windows, and weather stripping for that energy hog of a door.
Oh, the chimney's falling down and the roof is tumbling. Leaks let in the sunshine and the rain. And the only friend I've got now is this good old dog of mine in the little log cabin in the lane.
This is Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.